The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly. Coming up, Ed Miliband embraces Britain's squeezed middle. But who qualifies for the Labour leader's special attention, and are they the right political target? Also this week, it was promised to be Britain's greenest ever government, but why has David Cameron stopped talking about the environment? As Wales votes in the first of the spring's two referendums this week, we'll try and find out why the public seems so uninterested in what they're being asked. And hot off the press, Murdoch gets his way. The government clears the way for the media mogul to bid for full ownership of Sky, minus a little bit of the loss-making Sky News. Now, joining me for all of this, I have the leader of the Green Party, Caroline Lucas MP. We have our columnist friend, Martin Kettle. And down the line, we have The Guardian's senior and seasoned political commentator, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. So very briefly then, and we're not going to dwell on this too much because there is a whole podcast dedicated to this later, Media Talk. Vince went to war, but Rupert got his way again, Martin. Are you surprised in a word and why?
In a word, I'm not surprised, but I think it's quite a resonant decision with a certain group of the electorate. I think most people aren't into this question, but I think there is a group of the electorate, the media world, and of course we are quite influential, who's very concerned about this. And I think the decision by Jeremy Hunt to essentially circumvent the full process, I think will be a talking point in media land, and that will resonate out. Does media land matter? Yes, it does, because it sets the way in which the debate goes on, and it sets it will help to cast, I think, Vince Cable as having been a failure, a busted flush as business secretary, and it will reinforce the perception of the Tory party as being willing to cut any kind of deal to be on the right side of Rupert Murdoch. Of course, Labour would probably have done something very similar, but they're in the happy position of being able to attack it.
Luxury opposition. But Mike, I guess you're not surprised either, and if not, where do you think it leaves Vince?
Murdoch usually has his way with politicians. He's been doing it for 50 years, starting out in Australia, and he was patronised rotten when he came to London, but he ran rings around successive governments, and Margaret Thatcher let him have his evil way with her. Same thing happened in Washington and New York, so no surprise. I think I agree with Martin. It's a bad a moment for the coalition, partly because it makes Vince out to be a fool, which is rather disappointing. I'm certainly quite fond of him, and I thought he was abysmally treated by the Daily Telegraph in that entrapment operation at his constituency surgery. Would have been a criminal offence if the police had done it. And you feel a bit sorry about it, but the fact is Jeremy Hunt's obliged them, a much more sympathetic figure, and the Telegraph shot itself in its foot because, like the Guardian and like the Daily Mail, it was opposed to this on competition grounds. Looking on the bright side, Rupert Murdoch's 80 next week, he can't go on forever, and his empire will fall apart. All empires do.
So a cheering thought to end there. Caroline, you're not surprised either?
Not surprised, and also not so, he's got a big family, let's face it, so even when he does pass by, there will be others in his family that will take over the empire, I fear.
But they won't be any good. They never are as good as Dad.
Well, maybe. I mean, it's interesting as well, actually, the number of people that wrote to me about this. So, I take Martin's point, it isn't the big issue that's exercising everybody, but nonetheless, an awful lot of people have written to me, very concerned about this issue. And what a shame, in a way. What a good thing it would have been if this government could have challenged Murdoch. That would have really sent a sign that it wasn't what everybody thinks it is. I mean, everyone knew the government was going to cave into this, really. And if Cameron wanted to, frustrate a few expectations and show that he's not entirely predictable, it would have been a very nice battle for them to have picked, I think. Instead, it simply reinforces the idea that the Tories are in bed with Murdoch and that's just the way it goes.
So there we have it, business as usual. And as I say, if you want to hear more about that, and there'll be lots more, then you can listen to the Media Talk podcast. Now, the week began with a heavily trailed speech from the Leader of the Opposition, Ed Miliband. He spoke at the Resolution Foundation think tank, where he set out something of a guiding philosophy for himself, focusing on the aftermath of Britain's three decades of growing inequality.
One of the assumptions of our economy was that for many decades, rising prosperity would benefit the bulk of working people. But that assumption is breaking down. While those at the top have continued to do well, middle earners are no longer guaranteed to share in our nation's success. The result is a quiet crisis that is unfolding day by day in kitchens and living rooms up and down this country.
Mike, quiet crisis. Is it a crisis, and is it an issue here that Ed Miliband can pick up and run with, or is it just fairness and inequality and all that kind of thing interesting to The Guardian but not so interesting to others?
Well, it's much more interesting to the people on the receiving end of it. I happen to have been on the road the last few days covering elections in Dublin and the Welsh referendum, which we're about to talk about, and the Barnsley by-election is taking place today, Thursday. And you're very struck by, you know, bright, cheerful city centres, bustling with people, with students and with people who've got jobs and money and Blackberries and smart suits. You see them, and you're struck by the contrast with the people hanging around with not much to do all day, the unemployed. And that's true in London too, but it all gets swallowed up in a much bigger city. So it's very real. It's been going on a long time. Wages have been flat. Ed Miliband said, I think, that wages in the top 10% of the economy have gone up at double the rate of the rest of the economy the last 25 or 30 years. He also says, and he's quite right to say it, that Gordon Brown and Tony Blair did try to tackle this, minimum wage, other interventions, tax credits, of course, very elaborate, but got a significant number of very poor people out of poverty. But they were running up, not my phrase, but a vivid one, they were running up a down escalator, because the more they did at the bottom of the heap, the more the gap at the very top, and it's not actually the top 10%, it's the top 1% or half of 1% in those telephone book salaries and bonuses we hear about, raced ahead further. So it's a real issue. It's to some extent distorted a bit by those people at the very top, which make the figures, I think, look worse than they really are. What politicians do about it in a globalized economy when Asia is roaring away and taking jobs from the West, not just us, we've all got this problem. Miliband didn't address this. What we do about it is very problematical.
Now, Caroline, you've put, I think it's fair to say, inequality, equality more at the heart of the Green agenda than it has been before. Are you convinced it's a vote winner?
I think it is a vote winner. I mean, I think the conclusion really is that inequality matters. It's not just your net income, it's also how it compares to everybody else's. And of course, there's all the analysis that the Spirit Level and other reports have done, just looking at how corrosive inequality is. And so I welcome the fact that's now a little bit more on the agenda. I worry a little bit in terms of Ed Miliband's squeezed middle about exactly where that sits. And is this more of an electoral ploy to try to appeal to some groups that he may feel that are not going to vote for him next time around? And does it mean that the focus is actually going from the very poorest? Because let's not forget that particularly now under the coalition government, when you look at some of the changes to the benefit system, people in my constituency, for example, the changes to the shared room rate are going to mean that people are losing literally almost half of what they got before on housing benefit, people up to the age of 35 having to share rooms in a pretty basic way. So I hope that this new focus on inequality will also look at people on the very lowest incomes and people out of work, as well as what he's calling this squeezed middle, or what maybe Nick Clegg calls his alarm clock Britain or whatever.
I mean, I thought there's something interesting here, though, Martin, which is when Gordon Brown in particular talked about inequality, it was let's run the economy, let's make lots of money and then make sure that there's some money left to give to poor pensioners, poor children or other worthies. And isn't this language about the squeezed middle really saying instead of it being about the really poor and the rest, it's now about the rich and the rest, and implying that the majority, the middle and the bottom, are both a bit fed up at the moment. And there should be an opportunity for Labour there, shouldn't there?
Well, I think that has always been the great goal that Ed Miliband has always wanted to incorporate into his politics. Ed Miliband is quite a traditional social democratic politician in his way of looking at of Labour's agenda. He would like to form some kind of an alliance between the poor and the middle class. Getting the definitions right is obviously problematic in many ways. I think that the interesting thing about this is this. I thought his speech was very interesting, but I think it's to me still only a first effort at trying to anticipate what the question that is going to be uppermost in British politics in the second half of this Parliament is going to be, and to have an answer for it? Because it seems to me that once the cuts have really been felt and absorbed and are the life experience of the voters, including the voters who are only marginally touched by them but concerned about them, the question is then going to be, what is the next problem that Britain has to solve? And Labour, I think, is always got this temptation of being, the party that wants to roll back the cuts. It's the anti-cuts party. It's, it wants to put money in the pockets of the poor. It wants to increase benefits, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to have, I think, something a bit more elaborate than that in the wake of these cuts. And I see this as a really interesting but incredibly important evolving debate that's going to really come to the fore right through this Parliament.
Mike, one thing, picking up on what Martin's saying there about how Labour needs something to say other than just spending money, because by the end of the Parliament that might seem a hard thing to suggest. One thing Ed Miliband seemed to be bending over backwards to say in the speech is that he thought that instead of just talking about taxes and benefits and shuffling money around, Labour needed to change the focus onto doing something about the gap between what people earn before the taxman or the benefit office has got involved. The trouble, of course, is that what you do is a bit tougher, isn't it? He talked a bit about using the publicly owned banks to support fair-paying companies or regulations to support living wage companies. Do you think there's something he can do with that sort of agenda?
Well, there are mechanisms. Once you get into the detail, it gets hard. There are mechanisms which can work and can make a difference. The minimum wage was one such. Some listeners will remember what a great song and dance Michael Howard, I think he was Tony Blair's shadowing Tony Blair was his shadow as employment secretary in the 90s, said minimum wage would cost 2 million jobs and heaven knows what. But it didn't. It was a quiet success for the Labour government. Didn't get much credit for it, but that's life. There are mechanisms you can do to soften the edges of inequality and to redistribute money in a way which is fair and seen to be fair. Because, of course, fairness isn't just about taxing the profits of the banks, which I think Caroline's conference voted was 50% rate this week. People would be up for that, although that might have negative consequences if the banks leave. We don't have any banks to tax, so it's all these things are tricky. But fairness is also fairness between people who aren't so well off, and this old question of the working poor and alarm clock Britain, as Nick Clegg put it. It isn't all one-way traffic. The working poor has to feel that people who aren't working are looking for work and not having what they would regard as a free ride. It's a very potent issue among voters. And, of course, the worse things get, then the more sensitive it becomes. It can be done, but it isn't easy. And he hasn't got there yet. As Martin said, this is a work in progress. I didn't think he didn't grab my attention in that clip of the speech which we heard. He's not got there yet. As a public figure, there's still a lot to do there. A lot of goodwill for him in the Labour movement, but a long way to go with the voters.
I did find myself yesterday wondering where a farmer who wakes up with a cockerel is in Alarm Clock Britain. But Caroline, you just wanted to get in there.
Well, I just wanted to say that it might not be easy, but it's also not rocket science, and I would have thought at this point he could afford to be a bit more radical. As you suggest, Michael, I think that there is an appetite in the country for the bankers to be paying more in some way or another. I think there's much more scope to be really pushing the ideas around a living wage, because we've got a lot of evidence to suggest that actually it doesn't lead to the kinds of doom and Armageddon that some
remind
suggest.
People what you mean by that when you say that.
Well, a living wage would be, for example, in the way that the Green Party talks about it, we would set that at something like 60% of the average wage, which would mean that you would perhaps start off with councils, for example, and some businesses are already doing it. There's a living wage campaign in London where individual companies are now already paying that kind of wage. And, of
did
course,
Boris
people say you can't
that?
Afford it. He did back that, yes.
Yeah,
that doesn't automatically make it a bad thing,
although
it might raise some eyebrows. But the point is that, although obviously just as over the minimum wage employers, cried foul to begin with and said that it wouldn't be affordable. In actual fact, when you see it rolled out, there's lots of evidence to suggest that the increased productivity, the increase in terms of people being at work and less absenteeism and so forth, actually makes it a productive proposal as well. So let's have some radical proposals around a living wage, around things like more taxes on the bankers, on really cracking down on tax evasion and tax avoidance, because although this government likes to say it's doing that, it's also actually sacking a net number of people from HMRC, the Tax and Revenue Office. The Robin Hood tax, again, something just in The Guardian today from Bill Nighy, reminding people that a tiny transaction tax could be raising around $20 billion, even if it was only done in the UK alone.
So I didn't know he was a tax expert. I saw the article.
He's got lots of friends who are.
Okay,
that's important.
Okay, big menu there from Caroline. We'll have to leave this section here, but if anyone wants to read Ed Miliband's own menu, it's available at guardian.co.uk/politics. But now, shortly after the coalition was formed, David Cameron nailed his colours to the mast, and you will recall that they were green.
We've got a big, big opportunity here. I want us to be the greenest government ever. A very simple ambition, and one that I'm absolutely committed to achieving.
Well, ever since Copenhagen fizzled out, Martin, Cancun didn't really capture the imagination. Has Westminster given up on climate change, do you think?
Well, we'll hear from Carolyn on that in a minute. I think that Westminster thinks that this issue has lost traction with the voters. I think by and large, this is not seen as the kind of big dominant question that it might have been perceived two or three years ago. And the reason for that is the economy is stupid. Everything in politics at the moment is seen through the prism of the deficit and the cuts and so on. I mean, what I think is interesting for green politics going forward in Britain, and I think it potentially really interesting, is that if we get some sort of electoral reform, and we're going to discuss that a little bit later, I think the attractions of the Green Party or some sort of alternative radicalism are going to be quite considerable to a lot of voters, or at least to a significant minority of voters. And I think, you only have to look across to the opinion polls in Germany at the moment, where you have a Social Democratic Party, not unlike the Labour Party, that is struggling to find its voice and its message in current circumstances, and to see the huge revival in the polls of the Greens that's going on there at the moment, almost up on the shoulder of the SPD in the German polls nationally. And that is a really interesting development. And I, somewhere down the line, Caroline could be leading a party that gets 20% in the polls, but not in the next year or two, I don't think.
Well, not now. But what about now, Caroline? I mean, you've been in Parliament getting on for a year, haven't you? I mean, how do you mark David Cameron on his own acid test of being the greenest government ever?
I think the first thing to say about that test is it isn't intrinsically particularly ambitious, because Labour was so bad on the environment in most ways, at least until the very last years.
But how's he done on it, given that?
He's done pretty poorly. I mean, the first thing he did was to abolish the Sustainable Development Commission, which was the one body that could have measured whether or not governments actually were progressing in a green direction. So it's a little bit suspicious that you make this big claim and then you abolish the body that would measure whether or not you're succeeding. That was followed, of course, by significant cuts to the Energy Savings Trust, the Carbon Trust, bodies that very specifically giving advice to both individuals and businesses about reducing their emissions. The Royal Commission of Environmental Pollution is going. Natural England is being massively weakened. On top of that, you've got things like the Green Investment Bank. That's a great idea. I hope that it survives as a real bank that can really capitalise private sector money to the kind of ambition that we need. But there's still a massive row going on in the Treasury as to whether or not it'll be a real bank or just a fund and how much capitalisation it will have. So that will be an important test, I think. And then most recently, of course, we've had the forest U-turn. And I think what was interesting about that was not just the issue of the huge support for the forest, which the government had clearly underestimated, but just the way in which they clearly just regarded the forest as just another commodity to sell off. I think it says an awful lot about their attitude to the natural world. In the old days, I think people did see small C conservatives as people who had a natural affinity with the land, the forest, the farms and so forth. And this, I think, was just deeply shocking, because it just looked as if they were treating the forest just like any other bit of commodity. No real feeling for the value that people in Britain put on the forests at all.
You say that they've flunked it then, basically, by their own test. But how far do you think that this is because the electorate, what they're picking up from the electorate, maybe not the forest, but the sort of global issue of climate change aren't as focused on it because they're focused on the here and now, what Ed Miliband there was just calling, you know, a crisis in kitchens. I mean, and we've even heard, I don't know if this is a good or a bad thing, but we heard that the climate camp's been disbanded as well. What do you make of that? Well,
let me just treat those two things separately, if I could. On the first issue, I think that, you know, the general public are genuinely a bit confused about a government that will say climate change is the greatest threat we face and then actually not talk about it or do anything about it for a very long time. And I think it shows from government a signal lack of imagination, because there are ways of tackling both the economic crisis and the environmental crisis at the same time. They're not choices. And just because we're focused on the economic crisis doesn't mean to say that the environmental crisis has got any better. It hasn't. It's getting worse by the moment. But, for example, measures like massive investment in energy efficiency, home insulation. If you went through the country with a massive rollout of free insulation for people's homes, that would make a huge difference in terms of getting our emissions down, saving people on their fuel bills. So that would tick the box of you know, the squeeze middle, if you like. But it would also create hundreds of thousands of jobs. You know, it's one of the best things you could imagine doing for the economy. So first point to say is that they're not mutually exclusive. You can do both if you had a bit of imagination. Second, on climate camp, I don't sense that climate camp have closed up shop because they suddenly think that climate change isn't resonant anymore. To the contrary, I think what they're thinking is that this issue is even more urgent. They're still not getting the political momentum behind it that it deserves. They're looking, I think, about shifting their strategy away from the kind of the mass mobilisation and towards more kind of strategic actions, which we've yet to see what they're going to be. But I'm sure, knowing the creative minds behind Climate Camp, there'll be something quite exciting, newsworthy, you know, grabbing the headlines. This isn't, I don't think, any reflection that they don't think climate change is still massively important. I think they're changing their tactics because they're getting even more frustrated that it's not getting through to the political classes.
So, Mike, I mean, Caroline's saying there is an agenda here you could follow that will deal with the politics and the economics at once. But something does seem to have shifted, doesn't it, in the way that, for example, the protests that are capturing the imagination right now are more the kind of UK uncut stuff around the banks, aren't they?
Well, we mustn't be, you know, attention span of a gnat. We people in the media have a bit hopeless at that. You know, it was news, it was yesterday, let's find something else. I mean, they're both easily reconciled. And of course, you know, environmental issues aren't going to go away just because the economy is tanked a bit. And Caroline Lucas says there are useful ways in which we could create jobs which would be helpful in addressing environmental issues. So, no, I don't think it's just climate camp versus UK uncut. The point I would make about the coalition, though, I don't think David Cameron was being cynical about those huskies and environmental issues.
Smile from Caroline at this point.
What?
As a smile from Caroline at this point.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Honest people can have disagreements. I think they're naive about a great deal of things. I was on a platform the other day with the redoubtable Toynbee, and Polly said, oh, it's Tinkerbell politics. If enough people wish it hard enough, it'll happen without doing any hard work on it. And of course, in government, you find it's hard work about everything. So the forestry business, they didn't understand the policy. I don't think they were anti-forest. They just genuinely think the Forestry Commission represents putting up a lot of pine trees in inappropriate places. It hasn't done particularly well. And that diversification, same argument with the NHS, will just competition, different ideas, will make things better. That's not completely stupid, but they were naive and they really hadn't thought it through, and they got hammered and they had to U-turn. Or that's spelled Y-E-W, by the way.
Mike, I think, would you agree that, I mean, Cameron, I agree with you that Cameron did mean it when he went to the Arctic and all of that stuff. And I agree with you that it's more difficult once you're in government. I think my own view is that Cameron's credibility on this issue is still just about intact because the persona that he projects is so much that very traditional rural county Tory. But if that turns against him, if he becomes unpopular, really unpopular in other ways, people get irritated with what at one point they saw as his virtues and they become seen as vices, then, you know, I think it will it'll be a stick to beat him with.
Yes.
And I think at the moment he's playing a bit fast and loose with this image. And if he's serious about it, he needs to do some real stuff. And
there are days when he reminds you of Tony Blair, I'm afraid, but he's not as good as Tony.
Caroline, are you finding? You won against the odds with the current electoral system in Brighton. Are you finding that disillusion with the coalition is bringing you extra support at the moment? I mean, what are your feelings about support for the Greens locally?
I think it's very positive for us. I mean, the coalition is bad news for the country, but I think it's good news for opposition parties in the sense that, you've got the Lib Dems now that are so closely bound into the decisions the coalition is making and is unable at the minute to project any distinctive personality of their own, that there are a lot of Lib Dem voters out there who are furious and who are saying they will never vote Lib Dem again. And we are able to show that there are many of the policies that we have that are very sympathetic to Lib Dem voters. So that's certainly positive. I think the win in Brighton has done quite a bit for the credibility of the Green Party, just that sense that it can happen, and once it has happened, be that on a particular council or indeed in this case at Westminster, that builds momentum, I think, and makes people believe that a Green vote isn't a wasted vote, it is a positive vote. So I think in that respect things are looking good for us.
Okay, well, this is Politics Weekly and this is also polling day, so we can't go without talking about the matters that are going to be resolved in a referendum today, which is whether the Welsh Assembly should have more powers in certain policy areas such as health and education, specifically whether it can change law in those areas without a note from its mum at Westminster. Well, Michael White, it's the story that no one's talking about in London. You have been in Cardiff. Is there any excitement even there?
Oh, they're not talking about it much there either. It's a technical matter, and put simply, when Wales got devolution in 1997-99, it didn't get the power to legislate in the way in the defined areas. Not everything, defence, social security, tax, most of taxation don't go to Scotland. Interestingly enough, London kept abortion because it's such a divisive issue in Scotland, Catholic-Protestant thing. So in those areas, Wales didn't get the same powers. It had to go to London and say, can we, the example they cite in Wales is, can we legislate on sprinkler laws? That's garden sprinklers, and we think it's a good idea to ban smoking in public places. By the time they'd got the okay from the Secretary of State in London and the Welsh Committee in the House of Commons and I think the House of Lords, everybody else had caught up with Wales and banned smoking in public places. They're a bit sore about that, the Yes camp, and say, come on, we've grown up. Okay. Give us more scope to initiate our own legislation. And the Noes, to whom I thought George Monbiot was a bit uncharacteristically intemperate and unkind in The Guardian this week, the Noes are saying, trouble is with, some of them are just bad-tempered old grouches who never liked devolution anyway, but the more thoughtful of them say, Cardiff Bay is replicating a Whitehall model. They're centralising it all on the Welsh Assembly and the Welsh Assembly government in Cardiff Bay. And real devolution, I hope Caroline Lucas is nodding her head again, real devolution is about kind of getting it further down than that, getting power further down.
Well, I'm nodding my head.
Caroline's okay. Nodding. Martin, it sounds from, although, OK, you've got a point there about what happens at the local level, the parish level or the council level, it sounds like really it's a bit of a no-brainer that if you're going to give the Welsh Assembly these powers, they should be able to do things quickly rather than with an unnecessary delay. So why do we need this referendum at all?
Well, I agree. Both things are true. The Welsh Assembly does need these more efficient powers. There's no question about that, I think. If I was Welsh, I would certainly be voting yes, as the Guardian editorial advised people to do. But at the same time, I think as a nation, as a United Kingdom, I do think we need to have a rather better frame for looking at the questions that we put to referendum. And I think this was not really the right question to put to a referendum. There seems to be a kind of general consensus that major constitutional questions are appropriate for referendums. But if you know, there's a lot of disagreement about what that actually means. Clearly, if we were going to abolish the monarchy or elect the House of Lords or maybe change the currency, those are matters for referendums. But a question about moving into Section 4 of the Government of Wales Act, which is what this referendum is about, I think that's a bit of a stretch. And I think it slightly debases the currency of referendums, which should be which should deal with pretty clear questions which people can have a view on, and which will change things.
And Caroline, what do you think of it? You're part of a representative democracy now. Would you like to see more direct democracy?
I think there is certainly a role for direct democracy, but I think then rules governing it need to be a lot clearer. So, for example, one of the reasons that people aren't so exercised about this in Wales is there hasn't been that much information out there. The no to the greater powers for the Assembly have basically said that they don't want to take advantage of the free leaflets, the free airtime, which means that the yes side can't either. So,
the whole thing's
been closed down. Similarly, you know, when we look at the other referendum, which I guess we're going to come to in a second about the alternative vote, again, masses of misinformation is being put out by the No campaign about the cost of it and so forth. And there doesn't seem to be any independent arbitrator. I mean, the Electoral Commission doesn't seem to be playing that role yet. The advertising standards isn't about exactly what information is put out into the public domain. And so it's deeply confusing for people. So I think if we're going to have more direct democracy, which broadly speaking I'm in favour of, I think we do need to have clearer rules governing, the access to airtime and indeed what you do with it to make sure that the messages that you're portraying are objective ones and not deeply misleading ones.
We're almost out of time, but I just want to ask you, Caroline, on that second referendum, that alternative vote referendum in May, I think you're campaigning for a yes. And could you explain in a word why that is, or in a sentence, and then what you think the prospects for success are?
If I put a few sub-clauses in there, it'll be easier. I'm campaigning for a yes vote because I think it's one step towards the greater electoral reform that we need. I'm quite upfront about that. I've always said that the number of options on the ballot paper ought to be wider, and I put an amendment to that effect in Westminster, which was voted down, sadly. But it should be up to the public to decide what kind of voting system we have, not the government just to say, well, do you want AV or the status quo? But having said that, I think if we got a no vote in this election, then that would send, or at least the government would choose to interpret that as saying that people don't want any kind of constitutional reform. I think that would freeze up constitutional reform, be that in the Lords or anywhere else in the UK, you know, for a generation. So the AV, it gets rid of tactical voting. It means that you can vote for what you believe in. It means that you can express that preference, which I think will be very helpful. It means that people don't feel so disenfranchised. It doesn't go as far as we'd like, but I don't think we should let the best be the enemy of the good.
And they can chance their arm on voting Green.
Exactly so.
Oh, Steady on there. I've just come back from Dublin. It doesn't get rid of tactical voting. I'm genuinely torn on this issue. I know why Caroline's arguing the way she does. People want more choices. I understand that. Doesn't get rid of the dilemmas of politics. And in Ireland, they have STV, the voting system I imagine you want. It didn't stop the three Greens in the Dáil, the Irish Parliament, from supporting the Fianna Fáil government, which ruined the economy.
That's a very different issue, Michael.
What?
That's a very different issue.
Gets rid of tactical voting was has got me. I listen to people talking, having a wonderful time talking about tactical
voting. You can vote for what you believe in first. Okay. You don't have to not vote for Green for fear of letting something horrible in, and that would make a big difference.
Well, there's still tactical voting. Take my word for it.
Not least because I got slightly mauled on the web yesterday for getting into this territory. There's a lot of obsessives out there about whether AV does or does not get rid of tactical voting. And I've been on a steep learning curve. I think it does in some cases, but not many. I'll post more about that later, if I can face it. But for now, we're going to leave that. And so I'd say a big thank you to Caroline Lucas for coming in, to Michael White and to Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.